Now we're going to get down to this guy from the Corn Belt. A lot of us here has heard our speaker tonight. And he must be pretty good. We got him back. I think he has quite a message for everybody. I think it's quite inspirational. It shows you what one man can do if he makes up his mind to do it. And this is about all I'm going to say about him, Judge Ray H. of Des Moines, Iowa.
I like the dignity that you have here in Stockton. There's a lot of you here who are not alcoholics, and I can tell by the looks on some of your gossipy faces, you're wondering which ones are the alcoholics. Well, the ones with the peaceful, contented looks on their faces, they're the members of AA. I'm not a very fancy speaker. Not a very fancy judge, either. I'm perhaps the only judge in the world who's been 18 times in his own jail for being drunk. So when I give a guy 5 days, I know where he's going. Recently, I attended a minority group meeting, and first of all, I want to say that I'm delighted that so many of the municipal court are here. In AA, we don't get mixed up in politics, but I might say that if I were here, I'd vote for Judge Jahini, who came right in the middle of his campaign to this meeting. That'll rattle the bones of some of the cardinals that are here. Recently, I attended a minority group meeting, as you do when you're in politics. And to show that I'm a mental case, in addition to being an alcoholic, on the way home, I got to laughing to myself as I drove home that I, too, was a member of a minority group. I'm fat. I'm old. I'm a Catholic. I'm a Republican. I'm an alcoholic. And I got 19 payments yet due on an Edsel. How low can you get? Today, after we arrived in Stockton, I was reminded of 25 years ago when Notre Dame played Southern Cal at South Bend. And I like the anonymity part of AA. Usually when they introduce me as Judge Ray H. And then they say, we want you to meet his wife, Mrs. Harrison. We're foxy, you know. But on this Saturday afternoon, a day much like today, there were 56,000 people in the stands at South Bend, and the announcer down on the field who was calling the plays, a drunk got the microphone away from him and asked everybody in the stands to stand up and sing Sweet Adeline. Well, everybody in the stands laughed a little bit. And finally, three great big husky policemen came and very roughly took that drunk off the field amid the laughter of the 56,000 people. I was one of the four that left the field that afternoon. I might say I've never been a policeman. Currently in Congress, they're having quite a to-do about liquor advertisements and what part they play in making alcoholics. I don't think they play any, but they're having a big argument about it in Congress, wanting to stop liquor ads. I kind of enjoy reading the liquor ads now, looking at them through the eyes of an alcoholic. Because they take on a different flavor to me. First, and sure, is the Pabst Blue Ribbon ad. It shows a beautiful doll lying down on the grass, drinking beer. And here's a man drinking beer with one hand and painting with the other. That's what we call control drinking. Mama used to complain about the guys I'd bring home at 4 o'clock in the morning for breakfast, you know, when I was drinking. The guy in the White Horse Scotch ad brought a horse home. I never did that. He's sitting on the end of the horse. That's quite familiar to me. Here's an ad on Canadian Club that shows a policeman. Jack ought to enjoy this. A policeman surrounded by a lot of different bottles of whiskey. And the ad says, why did all of these whiskeys, 65 of them, try to imitate Canadian Club? And I counted the bottles and there's only 62 there. Which means that the copper has heisted 3 of the quarts already. Here's the vodka Smirnoff vodka ad. Shows a man with a bull's papier-mâché head on, seated at a table, drinking what appears to be vodka. And I have to be very careful when I read this. It says, bullshot. The vodka drink with beef in it. You can't miss with a bullshot. Simply pour good beef bouillon over ice, add a shot of Smirnoff vodka, and garnish with a twist of lemon. I bet that lemon does a hell of a lot for it. The only alcoholics all pride themselves being con artists, you know, and cunning and planning things out. This story illustrates it about the fellow who was having trouble with his lovemaking, and he went to the family doctor and told him he's having trouble. He says, you have an extra room here, and I'd like to bring my girl here and make love in the room, and you stick your head in 2 or 3 times during the hour and tell us what we're doing that's wrong. The doctor said, all right. So the drunk went in the room and made love to his girl, and the doctor stuck his head in 3 or 4 times, and they were there an hour after they came out. The doctor said, I don't see a thing wrong that you're doing. Would you like to come back? Oh, yes, the drunk said we'd like to use the room again tomorrow morning at 9 if we could. And so they were there the next morning. The doctor stuck his head in 3 times. After they come out, the doctor said, I don't see a thing wrong that you're doing. He said, basically, what is your trouble? Said the drunk. Well, the drunk says, if we make love at my house, my wife objects. If we make love at her house, her husband objects. If we get a motel, that costs $15. And here we can come for an office call for $4, and Blue Cross pays half of that. Back in Iowa there, we have a lot of these little two-story hotels run by one man. This alcoholic salesman checked out of his room and he left his umbrella in the room, didn't miss it until he was 10 miles out of the road, so he thought he'd get it that night. He didn't know that as he checked out of that room, a young married couple on their honeymoon checked in. So the salesman, after having 15 or 20 gurgles during the day, went back to the hotel that night and up the stairs 4 at a time and just about to open the door of the room, and he heard a man's voice on the inside say, whose cute little baby blue eyes are those? And he heard the girl's voice say, they're yours, honey, all yours. And he heard the man's voice say, whose cute little pug nose is that? And he heard the girl say, it's yours, honey, all yours. And he heard the man's voice say, whose cute little rosy red lips are those? And he heard the girl's voice say, it's yours, honey, all yours. And the drunk outside said, when you come to that umbrella, that's mine. They tell a story about Chester on the Matt Dillon show. Came in riding a horse without any clothes on to the marshal's office. Marshal Dillon come out and said, Chester, what are you doing? Well, Chester said, Mr. Dillon, I'm not doing nothing. Said, I went on a picnic with one of Kitty's girls. She packed a nice picnic lunch, and we went up on the hill there and ate it there and ate it. After dinner, she took off her clothes, and I took off mine. She said, let's go to town. I guess I just beat her into town, that's all. I find this drinking thing has been going on for quite some time. It's going to be going on for quite some time in the future, too. I just came from the National Association of Judges at Colorado Springs, where they had quite a discussion about the Eastern driver cases. And Peter Hutt was there, the attorney who represented driver at the Court of Appeals. And he took the attitude that it wouldn't be long until we wouldn't be arresting drunks on the street anymore, because in substance the holding of those cases was that you couldn't detain a man, a drunk who had been diagnosed as a chronic alcoholic, for punishment. You could detain him only for treatment. And he indicated that it wouldn't be long until the police would be given orders not to arrest drunks. Well, I think that's a long time off. Not in our lifetime. He also ridiculed our court classes, now that are over 100 in number in the United States, where the judge, instead of sitting on his soft chair, tries to help him. And in all cases, without exception, the judges are helping him. And Judge Clifton of the Superior Court in Los Angeles answered this young, bright gentleman. He's a very smart young fellow, but, and told him in no uncertain terms that after all is said and done, you're going to come back to the basic philosophy of Alcoholics Anonymous if you're going to help these drunks. And it don't make a damn bit of difference whether they're a skid row drunk or from the other side of the tracks. When they're in the bum cell, they all look alike. Now, the original log of the United States Constitution reads as follows. On August the 23rd, 1779, the Constitution set sail from Boston. She left with 475 officers and men, 48,600 gallons of fresh water, 7,400 cannon shot, 11,600 pounds of black powder, and 79,000 gallons of rum. Permission to harass and destroy English shipping. Making Jamaica on October the 6th, she took on 825 pounds of flour and 68,300 gallons of rum. Then she headed for the Azores, arriving there on November 12th. She provisioned with 550 pounds of beef and 54,300 gallons of Portuguese wine. On November the 18th, she set sail for England. Pardon me. In the ensuing days, she defeated 5 British men of war and captured and scuttled 12 English merchantmen, salvaging only the rum. By January 27th, her powder and shot were exhausted. Unarmed, she made a night raid up the Firth of Clyde. Her landing party captured a whiskey distillery and transferred 40,000 gallons aboard by dawn. Then she headed for home. The United States Constitution arrived in Boston in February 1780 with no cannon shot, no food, no powder, no rum, no whiskey, no wine, and 48,600 gallons of stagnant water. So you see, this drinking's been going on for some time. Pretty good fighters, those guys were. I'm glad that you laughed. I think laughter is an important part of staying sober. It is for me. Now, bear in mind, I'm no expert on staying sober, and anything that I say about Alcoholics Anonymous is only about as it has rehabilitated me and my group in Des Moines, Iowa. And if you disagree with me, Remember this, you have a constitutional right to be wrong. I think sometimes we make our meetings so sordid that the man doesn't come back. In other words, if we could wrap up our sobriety with a cellophane that glows with happiness, the guy across the street who's watching me may decide that Harrison likes what he's doing, and maybe I'll join that nutty thing called AA. In other words, I'm not only of this opinion myself, but listen to what Dr. Murray Banks, a noted psychiatrist, says in a recent article in McCall's magazine, How to Rub Shoulders with Happiness. And of course, we call it serenity, but it's about the same, happiness. He has in this article what he calls the six pills to happiness. Listen how closely they are synonymous to our 12 steps. The first pill is stop lying to yourself. The second pill, give your old age a kick. The third pill, murder your worries. The fourth pill, live your life one day at a time. The fifth pill, form a picture in your mind of what you'd like to be and be it. And the sixth pill, and most important, says Dr. Banks, is bless yourself with the light touch. Now, you remember Fulton Osler, when he wrote the piece about grace, charming is the word for alcoholic, when he wrote in that piece, go with them to one of their meetings and hear their laughter. And at whom are they laughing? They're laughing at themselves. And that's why alcoholics are such charming people to be with by candlelight. Dr. Murray Banks says, I saved this bless yourself with a light touch for the last, because without it all is lost, and with it nothing is ever lost. If you have it, you're richer than emperor or king. If you lack it, no amount of money can ever buy it. Inflation cannot wipe it out. The government cannot take it from you. There's no tax on it. No thief can rob you of it. There's no place in the world you can buy it. It's life's cheapest luxury, laughter. And Banks says, I know of nothing that'll make you more beautiful, better help you face and solve your problems, and keep you rubbing shoulders with happiness more effectively than the ability to laugh. Laughter is the best medicine, says Banks, a priceless elixir that tones up the skin and freshens the soul. It has a cosmetic effect on the entire body. And then listen to this. He says, beware lest the wrinkles of the heart extend to the face. And the judges that are here will vouch for the fact that their lineup tomorrow morning, as mine will in my town, will show a line of fellas whose wrinkles of the heart have extended to their face. And I'll show you some pictures in a few minutes that'll prove just that statement. Sometimes our meetings, we don't plan them, and as a result, a fellow don't come back. Let me tell you about a meeting I went to in Canada. And this actually happened. The meeting started out with the chairman saying, I didn't know I was going to be chairman for 5 minutes ago, and of course I'm not prepared. Well, that's always a great way to get the attention of an audience. And he said, I didn't bring my reading glasses, or I'd read the fifth chapter, the 12 steps and the 12 traditions. Well, you can't do that tonight. So I think what we'll do is discuss what I can best do to help AA. Pete, what do you say?
Well, Pete says, you know I never speak at an AA meeting. I never said a damn word since been here, and I'm not going to start tonight.
Henry, what do you say?
Henry says, well, you know my wife does all the talking at our house. I ain't going to say nothing either.
John, what do you say?
John says, well, I haven't given it any thought. Didn't know you were going to call on me or wouldn't have come.
But he said, oh, I think one thing we can do is help the hostess fold up the folding chairs at the end of the meeting. Hank, what do you say?
Hank says, well, I think we could help the hostess fold up the folding chairs. And we went around the room with 20 men, and every one of them folded up the folding chairs.
And it came to me, and I said, I hope there's no new drunk here tonight, because he might readily conclude that all you've got to do to get sober is fold up some folding chairs. Now, we have meetings like that.
what's happening to us. We don't prepare them. And then I'm going to tell you something about the formation of AA in Iowa, only for one purpose. Sponsorship. My sponsor came 150 miles to call on me, and he was only a week sober. How many of you have ever gone 150 miles in the last year to make a drunk call? Are we getting apathetic or lazy? Are we satisfied with our own sobriety? He came 150 miles and he didn't know what AA was about. He had the big book under his arm and he hadn't read it yet. But he bought it to give it to me. And I took the book home, and I'm sure that Mama thought I'd switched to Calvert's when I told her I was going to read. Because I always felt I was different in my drinking, like that fellow in the Calvert ad, you know, that's standing by the fence with the saddle on the fence and no horse. Man of distinction. Graduate of Drake and Yale. Well, Mama didn't say nothing, and I started reading the AA book. And I finished it at 4 that morning. Mama and I had had a lot of Saturday nights where we'd play cribbage together, and she never kicked as long as I was home and sober. And thank God my son, who I'll see tomorrow on the way home, if only for 15 minutes, in Omaha. He's in his last year of law school at Creighton. Thank God he don't remember my drinking. He knows more about Alcoholics Anonymous than I do. He's been to as many meetings as I have. And I'm so thankful for him. He doesn't smoke. He doesn't drink. He doesn't swear. He takes after his mother. Well, I took the book home and I finished at 4 in the morning, and I finally concluded that if those guys in the book were alcoholics, that I was too. And that my kid and my wife, who I love very much, and my mother deserved that I try AA, although I didn't think it would work, that I was too far gone. But at least I should, for them, give it a try. And I knew at 4 o'clock in the morning was not the time to call my sponsor back. So I waited till 6. I called him at 6. And now my wife's prayers are beginning to be answered. He answered the phone in Omaha. And I said, come on back. He said, I'll be there in the morning. Next day he was there. He said, when do we have the first meeting? And I said, we got to get some more drunks. And that was the first time I'd ever called me a drunk. I always thought I was a little different in my drinking. So he got on the phone, and I got on the phone, and the next day, we had 5 guys in my little law office, 2 of them drunk at the time. Now, whenever a guy says to me now, the meeting was kind of slow tonight, I wish you'd have been to that meeting with us. Nobody knew a damn thing about AA. I was the only one who had read the book. One of the drunk guys made a speech that we all applauded very heartily, and the text of his speech was what a son of a bitch his mother-in-law was. We're all in the same boat. I was afraid nobody'd come to the second meeting. So I said, if you'll all come to the second meeting, we'll have it at our home. We'll have dinner, bring some more drunks, and it'll be free. And what do you know, all 5 came and brought 3 more, 3 new ones. We set up a 3rd meeting, all 8 came and brought 5 new ones. We set up a 4th meeting, all 13 came and brought 10 new ones. How long has it been since your group had 10 new people there? What's happening to us? Are we satisfied with our own sobriety? Don't we think that there's a price we got to pay for the happiness we get out of Alcoholics Anonymous? And the price is to pass it on? If we don't, you and I know, every one of you, that our organization lives or dies on new people. And it isn't that they're not out there. The greatest leaders in Alcoholics Anonymous are perhaps drunk right out here tonight. The greatest leaders that AA never, ever knew. We say, oh, let him come to the club. He's not ready yet. We diagnose him. He'll never make it. He's a no good so-and-so. What's wrong with us? My group, I'm talking about. And then we have some in my group that think we ought to be poor. And please forgive me for speaking about money. If you don't like it, you can sue me. We have some in my group who complain that we should not pass the hat. And if we do pass the hat, they immediately have to go to the bathroom. Now, usually these are the same fellas that complain because they don't have turkey sandwiches served after the meeting. Or they don't have ice cream with the cake. Reminds me of the story about the very rich fellow who was in AA. And he never put anything in the hat. He was one of those that believed we should remain poor. His sponsor said to him, now you can afford to put something in a hat. We got to buy books. We got to buy literature. We got to rent rooms. So the fellow said, I'll give it some due thought. So he thought for 2 months. Finally, on July 3rd, he put a dime in the hat. On July 4th, he died, and he got to heaven. St. Peter said, what did you ever do on earth that'll warrant you getting in here? And the fellow thought real hard. He's just like the rest of us. He's been a scoundrel all his life. Couldn't think of a damn decent thing he ever did. And then he thought of that dime. Well, he said, on July the 3rd, the night before I died, I put 10 cents in the AA hat. St. Peter said, secretary, look it up. So the sec went through the books, and he said, yeah, I got it here, St. Peter. He said, on July 3rd, he put 10 cents in the hat. What do we do with him? And St. Peter says, give him back his dime and tell him to go to hell. We all have the same problems, exactly. Our group is no different than yours. We have some innovations in our group that we've had success with, and one of them is a penny bank that we pass ahead of the meeting. Tell everybody to put 6 cents a week in. That takes care of the contribution to the New York office. Last year, the penny bank did over $400. It doesn't hurt the hat any. We added another 300 to it and sent 700 to New York last year and the year before that. Easy way to get your New York contribution if you decide to get one. We have a slogan in AA, easy does it. It's hard for some of us to get that and put it into action. It means just what it says. For instance, when I was drunk, I'd get mad if I missed a section of a revolving door. Or if I missed an elevator when another one would be there in 30 seconds. Or if I had to wait at a pay phone booth, I'd get mad. Go out and take another drink. But things I find out in life don't come in a hurry. They take time. And a friend of mine wrote very beautifully recently how a day begins and how slowly it comes. He says, at dawn, the confusion of yesterday is history. There's a new day ahead, a day that never was before. It's still dark before dawn. Nights begin to thin away and the stars are dimming out. The sky has a pre-dawn glow, less light than promise of light approaching. That's the word for this hour, promise. A robin call. A tentative call as though asking who else is awake. The stars are gone and the promise of light has now become a glow in the eastern sky, distant and faint, but strengthening and spreading minute by minute. The birds are louder now, and they're no soloists. They become a chorus. It takes time for the sun to rise. Daylight doesn't burst upon us full of urgency. It's almost cat-like, stretching and opening its eyes slowly and looking about the world before it gets to its feet. It's very leisure urges that all the world's beginnings are unhurried. The first light touches the top of the ridge. There it is, a dazzle on the trees, a brilliance that makes the shadowed slope look pine dark. It's not yet sun up in the valley, but there on the ridge is the golden green light of the day that is coming. The birds are silent, a strange silence, as though holding their breath. Even the breeze is quieted. The summer leaves hang motionless in the expectant air. The day is organizing itself. For all man's frantic activity, the day still begins at its own pace. Each new day offers us a clean, rested chance to get on with life. The invitation is there with every dawn to start out to cherish or discard the hurts, the triumphs, the achievements and defeats of yesterday, and to plan another day. The sun is up now. It has just lifted above the horizon, and the long golden light shines through the big maples, making their leaves glisten like thinnest flakes of jade. It reaches across the meadow, jeweling the grass, leaping the pools of shadow that still lie in the little hollows. There in the grass at my feet is a spider web spun between the tall stems, a silver net diamond with dewdrops. And the birds are singing now a hallelujah. And the leaves begin to whisper their own song. And then this writer says, I get up early to be alone with myself, to see if I can live with me for another day. I liked it because it emphasizes what we try to emphasize by saying, easy does it. Take it easy. You know, three drunks together, one will say, let's go to Kansas City. The other say, let's go to Chicago. And they end up in Minneapolis. Fast decisions. And to any new people that are here tonight, if you have a decision to make, take it up with your sponsor. His mind is more befogged than yours. He can give you a better answer. He won't steer you wrong. Anything that bothers you, take it up with your sponsor. Don't think for a minute that any of us have to make any apology for asking God to help us. I used to think that praying was for boys with Lord Fauntleroy suits, and I lived to regret that. I looked about me and I saw some great guys, some great leaders, great fighters who were in trouble, not alcoholic trouble, of course, but other trouble that got out of it by getting down on their knees to get back on their feet. And I think of Le Sueur's beautiful painting of Washington on his knees at Valley Forge. I think of what Lincoln said in the Civil War, with God's assistance we cannot fail. I think of what Roosevelt said in the Declaration of War on Japan, where he closed that memorial statement with, we will gain the inevitable triumph, so help us God. I think of what MacArthur said when they landed again on the Philippines, when he gave a public statement to the press, a pretty fair country fighter, pretty fair leader. He said, people of the Philippines, we are here. By the grace of Almighty God, we've again landed on your soil. Let the indomitable spirit of Bataan and Corregidor lead on. As the lines of battle move forward and carry your homes within the zones of operations, rise and strike. For your homes and hearts strike. in the name of your said sacred dead strike. Let no heart be faint, let every arm be steeled. The guidance of divine God leads the way. Follow in his name to the holy grail of righteous victory. So who am I, a little drunken lawyer, to contest that? I looked to medicine. I thought find a Nobel Prize winner for his work on cancer research and suturing of blood vessels, who said of prayer, I have seen men brought out of melancholy and disease by the serene effort of prayer. It's the only power on earth that seems to contradict the so-called laws of nature. So I'm trapped. I got no place else to go. But here, to you, to get well. Recently in Iowa, we got a federal grant of nearly $1 million to put on a crash program for alcoholics. Now that we got the $1 million, we're worried about it. Because we're hoping we don't make any mistakes. I'm sure that if we do, it'll be mistakes of the hand and not of the heart. But we'll get a lot of guys sober. You can bet your bottom dollar on that. I don't suggest now that all of you run down to Washington and try to get $1 million. You gotta first of all elect an alcoholic governor. About 10 years ago, a lot of good things began to happen to me. And I thought that was bad. Because I didn't want to get drunk. I like sobriety. I like everything about it. But I thought that I might get to thinking that I had something to do with getting sober, when I didn't. And I looked about me and I saw Pat Cronin at Minneapolis and McLaughlin in Chicago and Bill and Bob and Chuck and Al Badger in Dallas, and I could name them all over the country, who had long runs in AA, had, in addition to their being an alcoholic, another characteristic that I must maintain if I'm going to stay sober, and that was that they were all very humble guys. And I thought I was the kind of an Irishman that literally needed a kick in the pants every 15 or 20 minutes to remind me that I had nothing to do with bringing about my sobriety. Almighty God did that. I got the same brain, the same body I had when I was drunk and arrested. Mama and Almighty God. I couldn't stay sober 10 minutes without Mama. They're the unsung heroes in AA, the wives, the Al-Anon. And to you wives that aren't going to Al-Anon, and there's some that don't, let me say, if you're like my mama, you'd do anything to keep me sober. Mama said that while I was drunk. I'd do anything if he'd just stay sober. My wife never misses an AA meeting. All our meetings are open. She never misses an Al-Anon meeting. She makes 4 a week, and we've been doing that for 24 years. And we've got the happiest marriage relationship in the world, Mama and I. But I decided that I had to have some auditory sound to remind me, something that I could hear that would remind me that I should thank God for my sobriety. And because of the punch-drunk character on the Red Skelton show, I think it was, who was always hearing bells that weren't ringing, I decided that every time I'd hear a bell, to me it would mean, thank you, God, for letting me be sober. Now, it's been a most pleasant experience of my AA life. You'd be surprised how many bells you'll hear. We'll hear one before we leave this room. You'll hear the patrol wagon bell, which had a familiar sound to me. And if your house is like mine, I'm sure it is, the first thing that happens in the morning is the phone rings. Now, there's some writers who think now that your whole day is governed by your thoughts the first hour in the morning. I believe that.
you don't have any bad days anymore when you started out thanking God for your sobriety. There's no such thing as gray skies anymore. Now, it has another good effect. There may be some male alcoholics in the room who never have any bad thoughts. If there are, they can meet in the phone booth out in the room. You'd be just getting ready to hate somebody or have a bad thought or be jealous of someone or resentful of someone, and the phone will ring. And you can't think of two things at the same time, only one. Just like the grains of sand going through the hourglass, they might crowd, but only one goes through at a time. And so it is with our minds. You can't think of a cow and a locomotive at the same time. It has to be either a cow or a locomotive. And you can't thank God and hate somebody at the same time. It's an impossibility. You might try it. You'll find there's a lot of bells ringing in a day's time. On the airplane coming out this afternoon, the pilot had a communication phone with the stewardess. And it really wasn't a bell. It was some kind of a little buzzer and a lighted light, and she'd pick up the phone. But to me, it was a bell. Even though it didn't ring, it didn't tinkle. Mama has a watch charm, or a bracelet, filled with bells of all different kinds. So that I've always got bells around me, because Mama's always around me, except on these long trips. Now, 11 years ago, I was appointed to bench. I was making more money than the job paid at that time. But I told the governor that there's a certain class of people that even my AA group didn't want. And that was the bums in our drunk lineup. If they'd come to my AA group, they haven't bathed for 3 weeks, they haven't shaved for 3 weeks, they're broke, they're sick, they'd feel way out of place. Now, before we did this, we made some research. We found that most of the drunks in our lineup had, at one time or another, been to AA. But just because of this natural shun that we've given them, they never went back. And then we found that we'd arrested men as high as 400 times in my jail. We started 11 years ago saying, how long are we going to put sick men in jail? We're now getting to the place where that's the theme of the courts. How long is it going to be that we're going to put sick men in jail? Well, I was appointed, and 2 weeks later we had our first court honor class. There was only two there. The first night, the police department thought I had blown my stack trying to get these bums sober. I wasn't so sure of it myself. But I thought it was worth a try, that these guys in the lineup were at one time a babe in some mother's arms, and she thought he was going to be president. Something had happened that he wasn't altogether responsible for, that the community had some part in. So then we decided that we would coerce them to come to this meeting. I can see some of the old cardinals rattling again. You know, we say, oh, you can't force them to quit drinking. You don't know what you're talking about, my friend. There was all kinds of force on me to come to AA. I could either keep on drinking or lose my wife and my kid and my everything, or come to AA and quit drinking. There was force for me to come. We make it a little forceful from the bench. We say we're going to delay your sentence 6 weeks and you come to 6 meetings of the court honor class. We call it loving duress. Wednesday night of this week, there are 175. We call it loving duress. Wednesday night of this week, there are 175 in my courtroom of the worst drunks in my town. and 175 of them were sober.
Now, usually we have three or four that come drunk, and we let them come drunk. We usually let the drunk guy make a talk on how to quit drinking for 15 seconds. We have some great discussions. We start the meeting off by saying, if there's anybody in the room who's never been to jail, nor never done anything for which he could have gone to jail, will he please leave now? And so far, nobody's left. So you see, we kind of got the junior league in reverse. But they're the greatest guys in the world. Now, some of the courts, when we started 11 years ago, thought it would hurt you politically. Until my first election, where I got 85% of the total vote. The next election, 87.5% of the total vote. They weren't voting for Harrison. They were voting for the court honor class. We had people stopping squad cars out in the neighborhood, say, take these clothes down to the court. We have a clothes room at police headquarters now where we can clothe a man or woman from the inside out. We tell the service clubs to send us your outgrown clothes, not your worn out clothes, because we'll throw them away. And have your clothes cleaned and pressed when you send them because we don't want our bums to look bad. So presently at police headquarters, we have 300 suits of clothes all in cellophane bags. We have 300 overcoats. We've got shoes. Ladies, all kinds of ladies' garments. We have at the court class a doctor who gives free B1 shots to those that want them. About two-thirds of the class take them. We send each one of them a court letter each week. It's a mimeograph letter, but it has some therapy to it. If only for the 5 minutes that the guy reads the letter, he's thinking affirmatively of not drinking. So they've got a court letter every single Tuesday, that's the day before the meeting, for 10 years, 10.5 years. The only letter they get. Drunks generally don't write letters, and as a result, don't get any. They cherish these letters. They show them to their boss to prove that they were at the meeting the week before. When they come to the meeting, they address an envelope to themselves that will contain the court letter. Now, we have some other things we do at the court class that we couldn't do at AA, although the court class is nothing but Alley AA. Barefoot AA. We don't have any literature. We don't talk about the steps numerically. We talk about the content of the steps. We have some great arguments about God some nights. Remember, these guys are pretty far away from anything spiritual. But we've got 30 or 40 now that are sober 10.5 years, just coming to the court. We thought maybe they'd switch to AA after they've been to the court class for a while, but they fooled us. They come to the court class only. It happens that out of our initial 10.5 year dry guys, two of them now are making $25,000 a year. Pretty fair for a bum. We have 50 or so that are 5 years or more sober. We have 60 or 70 that are over a year sober. We have some that have made as high as 11 tries. We don't send them to jail. If they come back, we send them again to the court class. We know that jail is not a rehabilitation center, and anybody that says that has never been in jail. Now, I'd like to show you some pictures. We have another practice at the court class. It's purely voluntary. We have their last mug picture taken the last time they were in jail, which was taken against their will, kind of, by the police. Another loving duress deal. After they're sober a year, after they're 1 year sober, if they want to, they can go downstairs to the police camera, the mug camera,
and our police department will again take their picture. I brought 15 of them along. I want you. If there's one thing that the pictures prove, it proves that anybody can get sober if somebody will spend a little time with them, and in this case, the court. It doesn't necessarily have to be another alcoholic. All the other court classes in the nation are run by AAs, not by alcoholic judges like me, and they all have about the same success. Every year since we started the court class, the drunk arrest record in Des Moines has gone down. When we started, it was 5,564 a year. Last year, we arrested 4,028. And this year, it'll be under 4,000. We've had an increased territory in our city, increase in the size of our police department, but yet the drunk arrests are going down. And if our chief of police were here tonight, he'd tell you, it's because of the court honor class. So it is worthwhile. I know it's not the whole solution. I know it isn't the total answer. But I know that this is some form of treatment that's working. That the court can see that it works. Even though the guy is forced. And bear in mind that every one of these men were forced to come to this court honor class. None of them wanted to quit drinking. Didn't think they could. So, if we ever get so smug as to think we're great guys because we quit drinking, and God forbid that that ever happened to us, we need then look to the life of another alcoholic, Stephen Collins Foster, and cherish the possession that Almighty God has given us. You know, Foster died at the age of 37. In 1864... of mortal wounds that he'd received in a Bowery basement in the slums of New York. And his body lay unclaimed, unrecognized in the morgue, while he had literally, the town was humming the tunes he had given them and sold to Christie's Minstrels for $5 each, the price of 8 quarts of whiskey then. And I like to look at Foster as the kind of the typical alcoholic, because at the time of his death, no material possessions on his body except a tiny child's pocketbook, inside of which was a torn strip of paper, and written thereon were the words perhaps of another song, "The Gold of Friendship." And that's what we've got here. Guys that measure you not by the size of your purse, but by the size of your heart. And I can see in the words of his song the great love he had for beauty, the love he had for his home, and yes, even the tears of his wife. You know, the words go, "The sun shines bright on my old Kentucky home. 'Tis summer, the darkies are gay, the corn stalks ripe, and the meadows are in bloom, and the birds make music all the day. Weep no more, my lady. Oh, weep no more today. We shall sing one song of my old Kentucky home, of my old Kentucky home far away." Foster didn't have the same chance that I had. What a great AA Stephen Foster would have been. His heritage to mankind were the melodies that he stored like jewels in the hearts of millions of God's children, jewels of which they could not be robbed, and jewels that they carried with them in their travelings all over the world. In the palace of American genius, there have been many knights and nobles, but the Prince of the Purple Chamber lay dead when Stephen Collins Foster gently laid his weary head in the gentle arms of his maker and joined the old folks at home who had gone before. We of the municipal court of the city of Des Moines and Denver and Phoenix and Tempe and Baton Rouge and Hartford and Norfolk and 100 other towns intend to see that the drunks that appear in front of us in our lineup every morning get the chance to get well if they will but try. Thank you so very much.